May it please the court. My name is Mark Evans. I'm a 40156. I'm a public defender, and I'm here today representing Mr. Ezekiel Hofer. The single question before the court today is whether Mr. Hofer was entitled to an evidentiary hearing. This appeal is not about whether he should have been permitted to withdraw a guilty plea, nor is it about whether he is innocent of any offense. It is simply about whether he should have been permitted to present evidence in support of his 2255C motion. And Colorado law is clear that he was entitled to that opportunity so long as his motion, files, and record in the case do not clearly establish that the allegations in his motion were without merit and do not warrant relief.
You're not arguing that he has a right to counsel or counsel should be appointed?
I am, Your Honor. Counsel should be appointed, but in my mind, the standard in Silva for when counsel should be appointed is really indistinguishable from the standard in White for when a hearing is required. I think that's reflected in the Crimp 35C rule itself. So, and if he gets a hearing, he gets counsel as well, Your Honor.
Okay.
And here, the record in the file simply cannot establish that the allegations and the motions were without merit. And the heart of Mr. Hofer's motion was that the alleged victim of an unlawful sexual contact has recanted her position that the sex was not consensual. And there's enough in the record of files that indicates that that recantation has not, in fact, occurred.
Counsel, even if we accept that, you know, this would constitute newly discovered evidence, how do we conclude that he, you know, if he had exercised reasonable diligence, he wouldn't have found out this information, especially given that he had some information about the alleged victim and the fact that she had a boyfriend and maybe was not very happy about having the boyfriend find out about the events in question. So how does our record establish the exercise of reasonable diligence?
Well, Your Honor, in all candor, it doesn't have to. I mean, White is very clear that a 35C motion simply has to allege facts that, if true, would provide a basis for relief. And here, Mr. Hofer's 35C motion does, in fact, say that he could not have discovered this information through reasonable diligence on either his behalf or his attorney. And in support of that, it says that, you know, this friend of the alleged victim did not come forward to him until after his until after the plea had been entered, certainly. That alleged fact in the motion alone, I think, is sufficient to at least posture the motion to where it has to go to the district court for a hearing. Now, upon hearing the evidence, could the district court decide that, you know, he didn't meet the first prong of the Snyder test and that he could have discovered this evidence? Of course. But that determination has to be made at the hearing. I'd also note that the, you know, the name of the alleged victim's friend in the 35C motion is a different person than anybody who was, you know, mentioned on the prosecution's witness list or anything like that. So, you know, there's nothing in the record to indicate he was aware of this person or any information that she had before he entered the plea. And the law is very clear that when a witness recants, it is the trial court's responsibility to weigh that recantation at a hearing. That responsibility is apparent in Schneider, in Comey, in White, and in Simpson. Now, of course, and when the trial court assesses the credibility of the recantation, it weighs it against the prior statements of the same witness and statements of other witnesses and all of the surrounding circumstances. But that assessment and weighing has to take place in the context of an evidentiary hearing.
At this evidentiary hearing, could the defendant testify about the statement? Seems to me that would be hearsay. The statement by the friend.
Your Honor, I anticipate that would be litigated at the hearing. I mean, I'm sure that he, you know, if they got to the hearing and the friend of the alleged victim didn't want to testify or didn't show up, then, I mean, perhaps he would try and perhaps there would be a hearsay objection. And I mean, I have no idea how this would play out, because without granting the hearing, no subpoenas have issued and we have absolutely no idea who's going to show up to that hearing, what they're going to say, and what sort of evidentiary issues that's going to present. But that's why we need the hearing. it's categorically improper to deny a hearing. If, should any of the allegations in the 35C motion prove to be true, the defendant may have a basis for relief. And if the alleged victim in this case is recanted, then Mr. Hofer may have a basis for withdrawing his guilty plea. I think that the law and the facts here are very clear and very simple. I set this case for argument primarily to make myself available for questions from this court.
Other than the fact that this previously undisclosed witness came forward after the plea, do we have any information about the timing, or did he allege anything about the timing? It's very curious that, you know, he only raised this to the court after the revocation proceedings.
I understand your concern here. The motion itself indicates that she came forward after sentencing on May 31st, 2011. The revocation hearing was in February of 12. So there's no, you know, there's no indication in the motion of where within that 3-month time frame she came forward to him. But this is not a situation where, you know, the defendant reportedly got some information and sat on it for years and years. I mean, the time frames that we're talking about here are not that large.
Thank you.
What are the implications, if any, that he pled guilty?
Well, Your Honor, I think that Snyder squarely addresses that issue and indicates that, you know, it certainly does not mean that any of the law regarding when you're entitled to a hearing on the 35C motion changes. All of that is the same. Now, Snyder definitely indicates that once he gets to that hearing, he's got an uphill battle. Because, you know, there are very sound policy reasons for being suspicious of recantations, but that doesn't change the fact that the trial court is still obligated to hold the hearing and weigh the credibility of the recantation against the witness's prior statements. That, you know, still applies regardless of the guilty plea having entered. If there are no further questions from this court, I'll reserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel.
Good morning. May it please the court, William Kozlowski, registration number 37824 on behalf of the people. This court is well aware of the standard that defendant has to meet under Schneider. First, the evidence was discovered after the entry of the plea, and then the exercise of reasonable diligence could not have been discovered earlier. Charges filed, or the charge that he pled to, was actually false, and that the evidence would probably bring about a verdict of acquittal in a trial. Defendant cannot meet the standard under his motion. First, his claim fails as a matter of law because there was no allegation in the motion that he or his attorney could not have found out about the evidence before his plea.
Counsel,
yes.
What is the evidence? Let's focus on what that is, because it seems to me the evidence at issue is this statement by the friend of the victim.
Right, I agree.
And doesn't it seem undisputed that that statement to the defendant wasn't made until after he was sentenced? So we don't even have to get into reasonable diligence. That seems to be undisputed because that's what he's alleged.
I think the evidence at issue, and that the evidence that would be admissible in a new trial, should he get it, is the victim telling the friend that she made the whole thing up. I think that's the newly discovered evidence. Because, for example, if she made that statement, say she made that statement to her friend the day after the alleged assault, and his attorney could have found this witness, then it's not newly discovered evidence.
But as counsel points out, this wasn't a witness disclosed on anybody's witness list. I mean, this person appears to come out of the blue. Why don't we have to have an evidentiary hearing on that issue?
Because he hasn't alleged anything in relation to that. He just alleged that he found out about this. We don't know anything else about it. I agree with that. But it's his burden to allege facts that, if true, would meet this standard. And it's our position that he has not
alleged enough facts to get past that standard.
Isn't it equally possible that she told him after he was sentenced?
Sure, but he hasn't alleged one way or the other. That's the point. He has to allege that it
happened. Well, this is a pro se motion.
Right.
And pro se defendants are not very sophisticated in pleading their matters in court. And my question is, doesn't this raise enough information that it should be inquired into?
Our position is that while it's a pro se motion, he still has to allege facts that, if true, would meet the applicable legal standard. So if he is not alleged
which
that,
is probably the strongest argument for having post-conviction counsel for every defendant.
Well, that may be, but under Supreme Court case law, you still have to allege the facts to get a hearing, and it's our position that he has not. And counsel today said that there's a reference that he could not have discovered it in the motion. I don't recall that. I haven't looked at the motion in a while, but obviously this court has it and can make its own judgment on that. As to the other prongs, it's also our position that defendant cannot establish that the charges were actually false or that would result in a probable acquittal. And the reason for that is defendant's later admissions. After his plea, he admitted that he had sexual contact, knowing that she did not consent. And defendant, in his reply brief, he asserts that our position of that mischaracterizes the record, but I'd like to point out that at his revocation hearing, his deferred revocation, one of the allegations was that he didn't complete treatment because he was denying some of the of what happened in the report. And in order to refute that, public defender got up, and this is her cross-examination of the probation officer on page 22, and she says, we talk about him being a denier, and he says, but Mr. Hofer admitted to the probation department that he knew that it was not consensual, right? And she says, right. Question, he said that he was not in denial, he disagreed with certain aspects of the report, right? Right. And finally he says, and he later said that he did rape the victim, right? And she says, right. So my reading of it was apparently the same as the public defender's reading of it when he was trying to avoid a deferred revocation.
Now, that evidence, though, wouldn't be admissible in any sort of a retrial, would it?
I'm not sure, but I don't think it matters because the applicable standard for the court in the post-conviction motion is whether the charges were actually false. And I think the court can consider that evidence with regard to a post-conviction motion, whether it was admissible at a new trial or not.
Are these admissions made in the course of sexual treatment?
No, this was an admission to a probation officer, not treatment.
All right, I'm thinking in terms more of the third prompt, whether in a retrial would probably result in acquittal. We can only consider whatever evidence would be admissible in that proceeding on that prompt, isn't that correct?
I agree with that, yes. And even if his admissions don't admit knowledge of her lack of consent, his admissions still directly refute the victim's alleged recantation. To the probation office, he said it was obvious he did something that made her uncomfortable, and quote, something had to have been forced. So even if he's unaware of the lack of consent, it completely refutes her alleged recantation that she made this all up to avoid her boyfriend finding out about it. In other words, his admissions independently corroborate her initial statements and refute his post-conviction motion.
Well, those statements you referred to, though, those are a little bit ambiguous. They're not as clear as the ones you referred to earlier, where the probation officer was cross-examined and he supposedly said or admitted to having raped the victim.
Right, and I agree. My point is that even if his more ambiguous statements are that he didn't know
that he was forcing her. The admissions or the statements acknowledge that she thought she had been raped, and what occurred in the bathroom was not consensual sex that she felt bad about later.
I'm trying to figure out, are we talking about two different sets of statements? There was this cross-examination of the probation officer that you referred to, and then there are these statements in the pre-sentence report that are referred to. Are these the same statements, or are they different statements?
I think that's unclear from the record. I don't think that's clear whether it's two sets of statements or different interpretations of the same statement. Is there no other questions? We ask that you affirm. Thank you.
Thank you.
I wanted to address a couple of your questions about these statements. I agree with opposing counsel that it is very unclear from the record whether the cross-examination of the revocation hearing is talking about the same statements or different statements. What I would bring to the court's attention, though, is that the letter from the clinical therapist at the treatment program that was submitted in support of the complaint for revocation, the letter was submitted in October of 2011, that letter indicates that Ms. Troper admits the facts regarding his offense but continues to believe all the behaviors were consensual and denies the sexually abusive aspect of the offense. That's in the record at page 110. There is nothing in the record here that is so clear of a confession to the elements of the offense that it puts this court in a position where it can say there is no possible way that the credibility of the victim's recantation can outweigh the other evidence. Because when you look at the statements that he's made and the PSI evaluator's interpretation of those statements, it has always consistently been that he has been denying that he was aware that the victim was not consenting to these behaviors. Now, he certainly did say that after she came forward and accused him of sex assault and after he had the opportunity to reflect upon it, he realizes that something happened that made her uncomfortable. But that is far different from admitting to the elements of the offense to which he pled guilty. An attempted unlawful sexual contact requires that the actor compels the victim to submit, and that the actor knows the victim is physically helpless and the victim has not consented. And that distinction between the elements of the offense and what he's actually admitting to is reflected in the PSI evaluator's concluding remarks on page 15 of that evaluation, where the evaluator states that he's thought a great deal about this offense and believes that he likely did something that made the victim uncomfortable. Though he does not know exactly what he did wrong, as the victim never expressed any concerns to him. So this is not a situation where there's some clear confession in the record that categorically establishes that there is no way that a recantation can be found credible by the district court. And even the PSI evaluator didn't see that sort of admission on his behalf. Regarding whether evidence of these statements would be admissible at trial, because that hasn't been litigated, it's difficult for me to tell. But even if you work on the assumption that they would be admissible at trial, the district court is still in a position where it has to take the recantation on one side and weigh it against all of the prior statements by the alleged victim, by Mr. Hopper, by the other witnesses. I mean, all of that has to go into the weighing process. And again, whether he's entitled to withdraw his plea is not even before this court, because no court has ever received the information necessary to make that determination. That's really all we're asking for here, is the opportunity to present that information. At the beginning of the Attorney General's argument, it was asserted that he's not met, has not alleged facts that would meet the first prong under Snyder. That prong is simply that the evidence was discovered after the plea and could not have been discovered by reasonable diligence beforehand. Mr. Hofer's motion asserts that he discovered this information after the plea and he could not have discovered it beforehand. And you have to work on the assumption that he has alleged fact that, if true, would meet that first prong. Now, of course, when we get to the hearing, the district court has perfect liberty to evaluate whether it buys that standard has been met or not. But as we are postured right here, he has alleged the facts necessary to get that hearing. Does the court have any other questions for me? And so I'll conclude by saying that even after a case reaches disposition, sometimes new information comes to light that dramatically changes perceptions of what occurred. And CRIMP 35C exists to ensure that when that happens, an injustice does not occur. Mr. Hofer is simply asking for the opportunity to present evidence in accordance with that rule so that the courts can determine whether an injustice has occurred here. We respectfully ask this court to reverse the summary denial of this motion, remand this case for appointment of counsel, an evidentiary hearing, and meaningful resolution to his claims. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The case will stand submitted. And an opinion will be issued in due course.